Happening now, breaking news across the board in Buffalo. President Biden visits a community in mourning and says the racist ideology that led to mass murder there cannot be tolerated anywhere.
White supremacy is a poison. It's a poison running through our, it really is. Running through our body politic. And it's been allowed to fester and grow right in front of our eyes. No more. I mean, no more.
More on the president's visit coming up, including new word that the alleged gunman was not put on a red flag list after making a prior threat. We're also joined by Buffalo's mayor, who's standing by live. He says he won't let what happened be forgotten. Also tonight, key primaries in five states, including here in Pennsylvania, and especially here, a key test of the former president's influence. We'll have the very latest and a close look ahead to CNN primary night coverage just under an hour or so from now and later. Even as Ukrainian fighters give up their 82-day defense of Mariupol, a retired Russian military expert on Russian TV says his country is now isolated in the world and in real trouble in Ukraine. We want to welcome our viewers here in the United States and around the world. I'm Wolf Blitzer in Philadelphia. That's Independence Hall behind me. And you're in the Situation Room. We begin with the very latest we're learning right now about the alleged gunman now in custody, charged with first-degree murder in the racist mass shooting at the Topps Friendly supermarket on Saturday. He was not, as you know, from Buffalo, but more than 3 hours away from Buffalo, where details of a very troubled past are just now coming to light. CNN's Brian Todd has the latest.
In June of 2021, the gunman made a reference to a murder-suicide while attending Susquehanna Valley High School in Conklin, New York.
On an online class, he said to a teacher that he was contemplating a murder-suicide. The teacher followed up on that, and the suspect indicated that he was just kidding.
In a post, he writes he was sent to the hospital for a mental evaluation, but it only lasted 15 minutes, quote, because I stuck with the story that I was getting out of class and I just stupidly wrote that down. That is the reason I believe I am still able to purchase guns. It was not a joke. I wrote that down because that's what I was planning to do. Despite this incident, the alleged shooter was allowed to buy firearms under federal law. The DA says it's hard to tell if he fell through the cracks.
The New York State Police spoke with him, transported him to a local hospital for a psychiatric evaluation. He was cleared and released.
The suspected gunman put out a 180-page racist statement that included details about the firearms he had, including an illegally modified military-style rifle he allegedly used in Saturday's attack, and a rifle he says his father bought for him. The document says he planned to use the rifle and a shotgun to continue targeting black people elsewhere in Buffalo if he wasn't stopped at the supermarket. And from his social media posts, CNN has learned how meticulously he planned the shooting, making several visits, even drawing a map of the inside of the store. In one post, he wrote about a, quote, black armed security guard who questioned him. On March 10th, the shooter wrote, I'm going to have to kill that security guard at Topps. I hope he doesn't kill me or even hurt me instantly. In another post, the gunman considered attacking a church or an elementary school, but decided on the grocery store because of how busy a spot it was, carefully selecting a time when it would be busiest.
I'm blaming everyone for this happening and continuing to happen to our communities.
Police say the gunman shot people in the parking lot, exchanged gunfire with a security guard, and shot more people in the store before surrendering. We spoke to one of his former classmates.
He gave me a weird feeling in my stomach. For some reason. I don't know why. I mean, he was nice, but he was just really shy.
Did you sense that he might have been racist, or did you sense that he was just maybe odd, strange, or creepy?
Odd. Mostly weird sometimes. I mean, I don't like to judge people, but that's the impression I got of him.
Was it his manner of speaking or the things that he said that gave you that impression?
He didn't make eye contact with me when I talked. He, like, looked around.
And Brian Todd's joining us now live. Brian, investigators, I understand, are piecing together more of his actions in the months and days leading up to this brutal attack. What more are you learning?
Right, Wolf. The operations manager of the top supermarket told ABC News that she saw the suspect at the supermarket on Friday, the day before the attack, and that she asked him to leave, saying that he appeared to be bothering the customers. The manager's brother backed up her account, saying that the suspect was there posing as a beggar and asking for change. The local police commissioner, of course, has said that he was there on Friday on a reconnaissance mission. Also, this in tonight, Wolf, a state police spokesman has told CNN that New York State Police did not seek a red flag protection order against the suspect after he was picked up by state police following that threat that he made at the school. Law enforcement officials have told us that the suspect's threat was general in nature, that it wasn't targeted toward anyone in particular and didn't mention firearms. But we have to reiterate, in that threat, he did threaten to commit a murder-suicide. Wolf.
CNN's Brian Todd reporting from Binghamton, New York. Brian, thank you very much. Sadly, Buffalonians are not only deep in mourning right now, many are also on edge in the wake of a revelation today from Buffalo's mayor, who's joining us shortly. But first, I want to go to CNN's Shimon Prokopes. He's in Buffalo. He's got more on that late-breaking development. What more can you tell us, Shimon? What are you learning?
Well, Wolf, certainly people are taking advantage, sadly, of what happened here, in that they are calling in threats, trying to keep the fear alive here in Buffalo. A pizzeria, there was one man who called in a threat to a pizzeria, a local brewery. That man was arrested. Police yesterday saying that they arrested that man and he was charged with making a terroristic threat. There was also a Walmart that was facing some threats. As a result, they were forced to close. Of course, you know, what police are saying, these are kind of like copycat style things that people are doing to try and instill fear in this community. But Wolf, as you know this area very well, people here are not going to live in fear. Just over my left, there are hundreds of people now gathered outside here for a prayer vigil. Diverse group and kids and people from all over this area are now gathering here, despite the continued threats that people are trying to make and are trying to keep this fear in this community alive. People here say they're not going to go for it. They're going to stick together, and they're going to keep fighting, and they're just going to keep trying to move past this and mourn together, Wolf.
Yeah, this threat of copycats is really, really a serious problem. Shimon Prokopes in Buffalo for us. Thank you very much. And to our viewers, if you're a longtime viewer of CNN, you probably know that Buffalo is my hometown. Growing up there taught me a lot about the toughness and the tenderness and simple strength of the people I grew up with and I'm in touch with to this very day. People like the mayor, Byron Brown, who's joining us now. Mayor, thank you so much for joining us. I know you have a lot going on. You heard Shimon's reporting about these arrests. Have there been any additional copycat threats in recent hours? We spoke about this yesterday. I know the community is very worried about that. What can you share with us?
There have been two arrests at this point. The one Shimon mentioned, and another one over the intranet, where someone was making threats over the over social media. That individual was arrested as well. Police here on high alert at every level, federal, state, Buffalo Police, Erie County Sheriff's Office, and any kind of threat, any kind of prank, any kind of copycat activity will be taken extremely seriously. Persons doing that will be found, they will be arrested, and they will be prosecuted.
What's your reaction, Mayor, to the fact that New York State Police did not put this shooter on a red flag alert?
I don't know enough about that. I would defer that to State Police for their comment. There's just not enough information that I have to comment on that at this point. I think the state police would be the appropriate agency to talk to about the red flag law in this particular case.
Yeah, good point. I know you had a chance to meet with the President of the United States and the First Lady today during their important visit to Buffalo. I want to ask you about that. But first, I just want to play some of the president's remarks earlier today. Listen to this.
What happened here is simple and straightforward. Terrorism. Terrorism. Domestic terrorism. Violence inflicted in the service of hate and the vicious thirst for power that defines one group of people being inherently inferior to any other group.
What did it mean for you, Mayor, and for the city of Buffalo, for that matter, to hear the President of the United States call this domestic terrorism?
The President came to Buffalo, New York, out of deep concern for this event and the pain and anguish of people in this community. The pain that the families of the victims of this brutal attack are feeling. And the president did not mince words. He called this out as domestic terrorism motivated by hate. He also spoke very powerfully and condemned white supremacy as evil. He talked about white replacement theory as a fallacy, as false information being spread by pundits over airwaves and in social media. And he said that type of hate needed to stop. It needed to be denounced. And I am suspecting very strongly that the president intends to take action to prevent hate speech over social media.
What did you tell the president, Mayor, about the needs of the city of Buffalo going forward? And what was the president's message to you? I know you met privately with him for a while.
I talked to the president about the need for additional resources in urban areas in the city of Buffalo. Certainly, we are very thankful for the American Rescue Plan Act and the tens of millions of dollars that will be coming to this city through that. The bipartisan infrastructure bill, which will have significant money for infrastructure. But for decades and decades and decades, urban areas of this country have been left out. They've been left behind. They have been forgotten. And more resources are needed to invest in economic development, in business development, business growth, job creation, employment training, so that the inner city, the urban community in Buffalo and across this country has the hope and opportunity for people to lift themselves out of poverty and be full participants in the American dream. I did share that with the president. The president talked about his strong conviction to do something about the availability of guns in this country. I saw a president with a strong resolve to get something done on these issues that plague our nation, guns, hate over social media. And it was very comforting to the families to have the president here and for him to spend such quality time with them, expressing his deep concern for their well-being.
Yeah, my heart goes out to the grieving families. It was so important for the president of the United States to visit Buffalo and meet with these families today. Thank you very much, Mayor Brown of Buffalo, a city I clearly love. We're going to have much more news coming up, including our primary election primary coverage that's coming up just ahead, including some more breaking news coming into the Situation Room right now on the January 6th investigation, a potentially major sign of growing interest at the U.S. Justice Department. And later, as Ukraine's defense of Mariupol ends, why the war's momentum now seems to be going Ukraine's way. We're going to get perspective from a former U.S. Army three-star general. Stay with us, much more of our special coverage right after this. There's more breaking news tonight. One of the clearest signs yet of a very wide-ranging inquiry at the U.S. Justice Department in Washington in connection with the January 6th Capitol attack. CNN's Ryan Nobles is joining us live from Capitol Hill right now. So, Ryan, update our viewers on the latest you're learning about this move by the U.S. Justice Department. Tell us what's going on and what does it signal?
Yes, that's right, Wolf. The chairman, Benny Thompson, confirming to reporters here on Capitol Hill today that the Department of Justice has requested that the committee turn over some of their witness depositions as part of the Department of Justice's growing investigation into the events that took place here on Capitol Hill. Now, what's interesting is that the January 6th Select Committee turned down that request. Chairman Thompson saying that this information is the property of the committee. It's their decision as to how to handle this material. He said that there may be an opportunity for the Justice Department to review this information in-house, but they're simply just not going to hand over the hundreds and hundreds of witness testimony that they've compiled up until this point. That being said, though, Wolf, there are two important aspects of this development that have a lot to do with the two biggest investigatory bodies as it relates to January 6th. First, it shows, as you rightly point out, that the Department of Justice is widening their investigation into what happened here on January 6th. But it also shows perhaps a degree of tension between the DOJ and the House Select Committee, who both have similar goals but have gone about it in different directions. And that could be a problem as both of these investigations move forward. Wolf?
Is there any sense, Ryan, of whether the Department of Justice is following the Select Committee's lead to a certain extent? Is it known if there is any level of coordination, for example, between the Select Committee and the Justice Department?
Well, exactly the opposite, Wolf. The Select Committee has gone out of their way to say that their investigation is completely walled off from the investigation that the Department of Justice is conducting, and that their work is separate from any work that the Department of Justice is conducting. And in part, there's a reason for that, because the DOJ needs a level of neutrality as it relates to the Select Committee investigation, because as you know, Wolf, the Select Committee has handed over a number of criminal contempt of Congress referrals to the Department of Justice, asking them to indict, for instance, Mark Meadows, the former chief of staff, to indict Steve Bannon, which they've already done. They have not, of course, moved on Mark Meadows. So they've gone to great pains to not just share information back and forth without any kind of cooperation or coordination or without a specific request. And the fact that the DOJ has made a specific request and the Select Committee has turned them down shows that these are two investigations that are not coordinated in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah, this is potentially a very significant development we're watching. Ryan Noble's up on Capitol Hill. Thank you very, very much. Up next, John King is getting ready to preview a very busy and very important night of primary races here in the United States. Stay with us. We'll update you when we come back. Polls have just closed in portions of Kentucky, part of a primary night almost certain to make headlines, especially here in Pennsylvania, where the Democratic Senate primary is dominated by a last-minute health crisis, and the Republican Senate primary is at the center of a political free-for-all, and that's not all. CNN's John King is joining us right now with a closer look at what's in store tonight. Lots at stake. John, update our viewers what you're looking at.
Well, certainly, let's just start by setting the table. You're in Pennsylvania. Look at this map of the Senate races up this year. Blue states held by Democratic incumbents. Red states have Republican incumbents. Obviously, a 50-50 Senate. So control of the Senate is a huge prize in this midterm year. And when Democrats look at this map, that Republican-held seat where you are in Pennsylvania is their one possible target. Now, Democrats say we'll compete in Ohio, we'll compete in North Carolina, but when they dig deep down, they think that is their best target, which is why that race is so important. So we'll wait to get the nominees tonight. You mentioned the three-way free-for-all on the Republican side. Donald Trump has endorsed TV doctor Mehmet Oz. Dave McCormick's a former hedge fund manager, more of a typical Republican, if you will. A lot of former Trump aides work for him. Kathy Barnett is the surprise conservative surging candidate at the end of the race. The question is, can she win? So what to look for? When the polls close, we'll look down here. Philadelphia and the collar counties around it, Montgomery County, Chester County, Delaware County, Bucks County. That's about 30% of the state population right here. And there are a lot of Republicans who live in those suburbs. How do they vote? Do they break for one candidate? And then out here in what Pennsylvanians call the T, this is conservative country. It's all gray right now because we have no votes yet. But let's just go back in time, Wolf. This is where Donald Trump runs it up. in Pennsylvania, in the rural counties. Does that endorsement for Dr. Oz make a difference? Do Trump voters support Dr. Oz? Or does Kathy Barnett, who campaigns saying she's actually the true Trumpism carrier of the race, does she win out here? So when we count the votes, watch Philadelphia, watch the suburbs, and then watch this giant swath of rural counties and see if one candidate can break out.
And we, of course, will be checking in with you throughout this night, a very important night. There's also a tension on other states tonight, John, as you know, including North Carolina, where the fate of the embattled Congressman Madison Cawthorn hangs in the balance. What more can you tell us about that?
Let's pull up the state of North Carolina. Let me turn this off so I can pop it out here. Madison Cawthorn has been involved in scandal after scandal, controversy after controversy since taking office. Twice, TSA stopped him carrying a gun into an airport. He was driving with a suspended license. He angered the Republican leadership, Wolf, as you recall, by saying he had been invited by members of the leadership to orgies where cocaine was being used. He has since backed away from that, but the Republican establishment has broken from him. This is his district, the 11th congressional district in the western, southwestern corner. It's a Republican district. If Madison Cawthorn wins the primary, he's likely to go on to win re-election. If anyone else can beat him in the primary, likely to go on to win re-election. But this is a battle where Trump came in at the last minute, said, give Madison Cawthorn a second chance. Both of the state's Republican senators, the House Republican leader says, please, Republicans, nominate somebody else. So we'll count the votes here. Asheville and the areas to the west a bit later tonight.
All right, John King reporting for us. So John, we'll be in touch, obviously, throughout the night. Thank you very, very much. Let's get some more now on the key races that are about to get resolved. CNN's Jeff Zeleny is in Pennsylvania for us, not too far away from where I am. Jeff, as we heard from John, a very tight three-person GOP Senate race here in Pennsylvania tonight. What more can you tell us on the energy within the Oz, Barnett, and McCormick campaigns?
Wolf, it is surprisingly tight and uncomfortably tight for Dr. Mehmet Oz and David McCormick. That is all because of the energy from Kathy Barnett, really developed over the last several days here. While both campaigns were busy attacking one another, she essentially came up the middle through her hard arguments and complaints and charges that the election in 2020 was stolen for President Donald Trump. Of course, that is not true, but those unfounded claims really have propelled her candidacy. Now, this is something that if you talk to campaign officials from the Oz campaign and the McCormick campaign, they overlooked and underestimated her. And now they say she would be a risk to the Republican Party should she become the nominee this evening. She pushes back on that, and she says, look, she is a authentic Republican. She's a different kind of Republican, never run for public office except in 2020 when she was defeated by nearly 20 percentage points here in the Philadelphia suburbs. But Wolf, she's also pushed back on that, saying that Donald Trump lost the district by 26 points. She outperformed him. So we will see how it works this evening. But in the final 90 minutes or so of voting, it is the undecided voters at the end of this race that, of course, will make the difference. Did Kathy Barnett convince enough of them to come to her, or were the negative onslaught of ads against her by the Oz and McCormick campaigns enough to raise doubt about her? Those are the dynamics here as we head into the final, again, hour and a half of voting, Wolf.
Yeah, so much at stake tonight. On the Democratic side of the Senate race here in Pennsylvania, what more are you learning, Jeff, about the condition of the Lieutenant Governor, John Fetterman? As you know, as most of our viewers, I'm sure, know, he was hospitalized earlier this week after suffering what he called to be a minor stroke.
Wolf, he's been in the hospital since Friday, actually, and will not be at his campaign rally. That is because he spent much of the afternoon in surgery, getting a device inserted inside him, a defibrillator. So the stroke, more serious than it initially seemed. His doctors and his campaign said he eventually will recover, but he will not be on hand for the race. That does not necessarily change the race. Democrats believe that he is likely to become the nominee this evening, but he's running in a race with two other people as well, so we'll let those votes be counted. But a very unusual circumstance for a leading candidate to be hospitalized and not at his election headquarters, Wolf.
Yeah, we'll see what happens tonight. Thanks very much, Jeff Zeleny, on the scene for us, as he always is. Coming up, the focus on North Carolina Republican Senate primary, especially after former President Trump spoke out about the candidates he's backing, the embattled Congressman Madison Cawthorn. I'll talk it over with our political experts. That's coming up next. We'll be right back. We're now waiting for results in primary races in five states. Polls already closed now in portions of Kentucky. I want to bring in our political team on this very big night. Joining us now, CNN's chief political analyst, Gloria Borger, CNN's senior political commentator, former senior advisor to President Obama, David Axelrod, and CNN national affairs analyst, Casey Hunt, who's with me here in Philadelphia. Gloria, let's start with you. The effects of tonight's primaries certainly could be far-reaching indeed. What are you watching?
Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania, Pennsylvania. I think it's hugely important when you consider control of the Senate. When you take a look at the Republican Party and you see the way it's going to behave post-Donald Trump. And also when you look at that race for governor, if you have this conservative Mastriano running and winning, he gets to appoint the Secretary of State in the state of Pennsylvania. He has been an ardent election denier. And that's going to be a hugely important role in 2024. So in every way, it's Pennsylvania.
You're absolutely right. Among Republicans, David, is this a race to out-Trump Trump?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Wolf. What you have in the Senate race are in the view of some of the hard MAGA voters, you have one MAGA candidate and two counterfeit MAGAs. And the two counterfeit MAGAs are the ones who've spent $40 million beating the hell out of each other, each trying to certify their own acceptance to Trump and Trumpism. And the MAGA voters, or at least the far right of MAGA, saying, no, we don't believe you. She's the real deal. We're going to be with her. And she's twinned up with that governor's candidate, Mastriano, in Pennsylvania. And the two of them are threatening to take Pennsylvania pretty far to the right here, to the delight, I think, of some Democrats. We'll see if they say that in November. But one point on this, Wolf, the Democratic candidate for governor spent over $2 million on advertising, attacking Mastriano in the governor's race on the Republican side for being too Trump. The clear objective was to make him a stronger candidate in that Republican primary. He wants to run against him. He may get his wish tonight.
Let's see if he does. Casey, you're here with me in Philadelphia. You're going to be in Philadelphia with me throughout this important night. You know this state well. You're from here, from this area. You know Pennsylvania well. You know the stakes. I know you had a chance recently to profile the Democratic Senate candidate, John Fetterman. He's doing well right now. What can you tell us about him?
Well, he's had a little bit of a health scare here at the last minute. He's in the hospital having a pacemaker and defibrillator put in. Won't be at his own election night party. But he really has consolidated Democrats behind him. A lot of Democrats in Washington thought that voters would get behind Connor Lamb, who is a Marine Corps vet, somebody who won a pro-Trump district out in the western part of Pennsylvania. But he really didn't catch on. And instead, many Democratic voters seem to be, we're seeing this regardless of political ideology. They're looking for candidates who aren't necessarily part of the traditional mold, people who seem like they're coming across as the word I heard over and over again when I was talking to voters in Pennsylvania was real. John Fetterman he's a big guy. You can't escape his physical presence when you're campaigning with him. He wears, cargo shorts, gym shorts, and hoodies when he campaigns. And he really has made a concerted effort to try to win over some of those blue-collar voters. They were traditionally union Democrats, and then they were won by Donald Trump, especially in the western part of the state. So he hasn't shied away from trying to attract those voters back to the Democratic Party. So I think that's what's going to be interesting to watch about him as we approach the fall. I think one challenge he's going to have is energizing particularly black voters in Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. He's going to have some work to do there. But it does seem like at least tonight, unless there's a major surprise, he's on track to be the Democratic nominee for Senate.
I know. We wish him only a speedy recovery from a stroke the other day. Let's hope for the best for that. Casey, don't go too far away. Gloria, how much does former President Donald Trump have at stake tonight, especially here in Pennsylvania?
Well, he has a lot because he's been talking about it nonstop. And what he wants to do is just put check marks next to victories to show that that is his strength and that he is still all powerful, kingmaker, puppet master, whatever you want to call it, within the Republican Party. He's nervous. tonight because his chosen candidate, Dr. Oz, whom he often describes as a TV star who was on TV for 13 seasons and therefore must have an awful lot of appeal to voters, particularly women, is suffering even after millions and millions of dollars have been poured into his campaign. So I think it would be a major embarrassment for Donald Trump if Oz lost, particularly if he lost to Kathy Barnett, who is more Trump than Trump, and who has come out and said, we were here first. Donald Trump, you were the one who climbed onto our movement, not the other way around. And so this movement is about us, and she's clearly making the case that, yeah, we'd like to have you, but you're not the boss of me anymore, as my kids would say. We don't need you. We're moving on.
Very interesting. You know, David, as you know well, Democrats going into the midterm elections this year are up against very strong headwinds. J.P. Morgan, for example, just today indicating that the average price of a gallon of gas could hit $6 by August, not just out in California, but all across the country. How would that play going into November?
I assume that's a rhetorical question, Wolf. Obviously, it wouldn't play well. And there are very strong winds facing Democrats. That's why these elections are going to be watched so closely, because Republicans think they could have a chance to hang on to this Senate seat in Pennsylvania. But they fear that if they nominate the wrong candidate, they won't be able to hold on to that seat. And so, yes, I think that you know, everything, if you were a doctor and you looked at the checklist of vital signs, they're all rather negative for Democrats right now. What they're hoping for is that Republicans will save Democrats by nominating candidates who are more beatable in November and that they can withstand the headwinds that they're sure to be facing.
You know, Gloria, is it clear to you how much of an impact the draft U.S. Supreme Court opinion overturning Roe v. Wade could have on these races tonight and in other states in the weeks and months ahead?
Look, I think it's way too early to tell about the impact on the election. I believe that it's going to have a large impact if the ruling is, as we think, on the 2024 election, because people are going to have to start dealing with the consequences of the overturning of Roe v. Wade. Who do you arrest? The doctor, the woman? What? But tonight, I think, and you know, Kathy Barnett is pro-life, so are the Republican candidates. So I don't think on that side it's going to have that huge an impact. But I think in the future, this is something the Democrats will be talking about an awful lot.
Gloria Borger, David Axelrod, Casey Hunt, guys, thank you very much. One quick note on John Fetterman, the lieutenant governor. His wife just tweeted that he is out of surgery and the procedure to implant a pacemaker, was, in her words, perfect. Just ahead, we'll have the latest on the war in Ukraine and the battle for that steel plant in Mariupol. Retired U.S. Army Lieutenant General Mark Hertling standing by to join us live with his assessment. Much more of our coverage coming up. Ukraine's battle for Mariupol has come to an end. The bloody defense of the besieged city and the Azovstal steel plant lasted weeks. According to the Kremlin, both Ukrainian civilians and troops were allowed to leave the plant after the troops surrendered and laid down their weapons. Ukraine's deputy defense minister says 211 troops were evacuated through a humanitarian corridor, and another 53 seriously injured troops were evacuated from the plant to a medical facility in Russian-controlled territory. Ukraine's deputy prime minister says they expect to carry out an exchange of Russian prisoners for the injured Ukrainian troops. All this comes as the Kremlin guaranteed the troops will be treated in accordance with international law. Joining us now to discuss what's going on, CNN military analyst, retired Lieutenant General Mark Hertling. General Hertling, thanks so much for joining us. Just how significant is this? How worried are you for the surviving Ukrainian fighters in Russian control?
Well, if we can't believe anything Russia has said in terms of the treatment of prisoners thus far, because they have not done so, they have shown us what they are. But secondly, you know, what I'd say in terms of the fighters in Mariupol, they have done a masterful job in terms of delaying and distracting Russian forces. Estimates are that somewhere between 12 and 14,000 Russian troops were involved in that action, trying to maintain the logistics supply from Rostov in Russia all the way to Odessa. And it took them almost 2 months out of their norm that they could not allow the Russian troops to move further north into the Donbas area to fight. So this action by the Ukrainian forces in the Azovstal plant, even though it was very troublesome and very worrying, a lot of casualties and a horrible condition, it really saved a lot of Ukrainians' lives if they pinned down those forces in that plant.
I also want to get your reaction, General Hertling, to part of what was said by a former Russian colonel on Russian state television on Monday. Listen to this.
Let's not wave about rockets in Finland's direction. This just looks ridiculous. The biggest flaw in our military and political situation is that we are in total geopolitical solitude, and the whole world is against us, even if we don't want to admit it. And we need a way out of this situation.
What did you think of that? Let's get a little reality check breaking through the Putin propaganda right now. What did you think of that that statement from this former Russian colonel on Russian state TV?
Well, in listening to the entire clip, Wolf, that was just a small segment of it where he was dashing Putin's desires to divide NATO. It was a strategic implication. But I happened to listen to the entire speech by Colonel Khodorinok, and what he basically did was a damning combination of every aspect of the Russian attack, from the tactical competencies of the soldiers and the generals to the operational design of the fight to the strategic requirements that Putin put on his forces. They were not capable of achieving those kinds of strategic goals across the front. And many of us saw that from the very beginning when you're talking about only allocating 190,000 soldiers, which seems a lot. But when you're talking about allocating them along seven different axes of advance, along a frontage of almost 1,400 miles with different military objectives to seize and secure cities of over a million, in one case, 3 million Ukrainian population, it's just not capable of coming true. And I think Colonel Khodorinok actually nailed it from the standpoint of addressing each one of Putin's strategic and operational and tactical implications on this.
General Hertling, thank you so much for your analysis. We are always appreciative. Coming up, an 8-year-old girl's bravery when shots rang out at the Buffalo supermarket. Stay with us. We'll be right back. We started this hour of the Situation Room on the Buffalo shooting, and that's where we end it, with a brave 8-year-old little girl named London Thomas. On Saturday, she went to the Tops supermarket with her mom and dad to get a birthday cake for her mom. When the shots rang out, London and her dad were not with her mom. They decided to hide in a cooler.
We went to the back of the store where the milk is. And, like, the door was locked and we could not get out until, like, the manager opened the door. Then we had to go out the back door. And then, like, the cops lead us out. I was scared for my mom. I did not know what happened to her because she was at the front and I was at the back. I didn't know where she was. I thought she was gone.
Thankfully, her mom wasn't hurt, and neither was London or her dad. And London says she was never scared because her dad was with her the whole time. So brave. Thanks very much for watching. I'm Wolf Blitzer in Philadelphia, reporting in the Situation Room tonight. I'll be reporting from here throughout the night, along with my colleagues Aaron Burnett, Jake Tapper, Anderson Cooper, and reporters around the country for Election Night in America, the midterm primaries.
Now streaming exclusively on Max, a new CNN flash doc about the album that has Nashville talking, Call Me Country. Beyonce and Nashville's Renaissance. Watch it at max.com/callmecountry. Max subscription required.